Had I known that the introduction was going to be that good, I would have had my mama come up here. The day I came home to Texas A&M University after having spent a year and a half out fooling around in politics, a group of students came over to see me to console me about all this time I'd wasted. And they started off with the argument that I should be delighted to be home because, after all, people at home love me, as evidenced by the fact that on our campus I got 760-odd votes and Lloyd Benson got 19. And I wasn't too reconciled by that because obviously there were a lot more of them than there were us, except on the Aggie campus. But one young kid in the core had one additional suggestion of why I should rejoice at being home, which I thought was interesting. His point was that with all the reforms in Washington and with the response to all the scandals, that had I been elected, by the time I got there, all the fun would have been taken out. I'd like tonight to talk about the Humphrey Hawkins bill. I'd like to talk about it from two points of view. I'd like to talk about the two problems that it seeks to deal with, inflation and unemployment. And I'd like to then talk about the way that the Humphrey Hawkins bill seeks to deal with these problems. The Humphrey Hawkins bill is a fairly straightforward bill. What I'd like to do is talk about a conglomerate of the various versions which have been introduced before the Congress, and talk about how they bear on these specific problems of inflation and unemployment. I know I don't have to come here to tell you how bad inflation is. The average American consumer is paying $1.65 for the same goods and services that he bought for only $1 10 years ago. We sometimes get the idea from listening to politicians that nobody has the foggiest notion about what causes inflation. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. As I tell my Aggies at Texas A&M, in language that they understand perfectly, the occurrence of inflation, like the occurrence of pregnancy, is dependent on numerous factors, but it has but one cause. We in economics have good data on general price inflation that dates back 5,000 years to the 5th dynasty of ancient Egypt. So far as I am aware, as a person who has done some studying in monetary history, there has never been a prolonged period of general price inflation in the recorded history of mankind which has not been preceded by and directly related to a growth in the money supply. In fact, there is no single economic occurrence in the whole history of civilization that is better documented so far as its causes and cures are concerned than is general price inflation. We've had 5 major and 2 minor inflations in the history of the United States, and they've all been caused by exactly the same set of circumstances. Now, despite the fact that the people next door sound as if they're having more fun than we are, I'm going to give you a thumbnail sketch of those previous inflations so that in case you aren't an economist, that you'll believe me when I talk about the current inflation. The first inflation in the history of the United States occurred at the birth of our country. Under the Articles of Confederation, the Continental Congress didn't have the power to tax, and in order to fight the Revolutionary War, they were forced to print and spend a new form of paper currency. As they printed and spent this new form of paper currency called Continental Dollars, they entered the marketplace competing against private citizens for goods and services with newly printed money, and in the process, they drove up demand faster than production could grow, and prices rose. Many of you may have heard since childhood the saying, not worth a continental. Well, that saying emanated from the fact that so severe was the inflation caused by the Continental Congress printing and spending this new paper currency that when Continental dollars were redeemed in gold and silver at the end of the Revolution, they were redeemed at 2 cents on the dollar. The second inflation in the American experience occurred during the War of 1812. During this period, we were financing the federal government by taxing imports, which was not a terribly heavy burden on the American economy because all of government, state, local, and federal government, was absorbing about 1/8 of 1 cent out of every dollar of national income. But we had a problem during this period in that we were engaged in an armed conflict with our major trading partner, with a nation that dominated the seas and upon the initiation of hostilities blockaded our ports, so that the only imports coming into the United States were coming in by blockade runners, as they were called during the war, smugglers, as they were called during peacetime, but it seems that the blockade runners weren't paying any more taxes than the smugglers had paid. So again, our government was found without a tax base. It turned to the printing press, printed and spent large quantities of paper currency. And in entering the marketplace, competing against private citizens for goods and services with newly printed money, it drove up demand faster than production could grow, and we had our second inflation. The next inflation occurred during the American Civil War. During the Civil War, the Union ran a $1 billion deficit. Now that sounds like peanuts by modern standards, but that was, at that time, the largest deficit in any nation in history had ever run, which it subsequently paid back. And the Union financed 60% of that deficit by printing and spending U.S. notes or greenbacks, and in the process of entering the marketplace, competing against private citizens for goods and services with newly printed money, the money supply of the United States grew by 150% in 5 years. And by 1865, prices were twice what they were in 1860. The next inflation in American history didn't occur until World War I. During World War I, we ran a deficit to finance the sending of the American Expeditionary Force to Europe. We financed virtually all that deficit by printing money and spending it. And again, as the federal government entered the marketplace, competing against private citizens for goods and services with newly printed money, it drove up demand faster than production could grow, and we had a short but very intense price inflation. The next inflation, of course, occurred during the Second World War. We had first attempted to fight the Second World War, finance that fighting by taxing. Taxes got high, started to affect production incentives. The government sold bonds on the open market, ultimately nationalized the credit market, rationed credit to the private sector, but still the government was unable to finance the debt in this fashion. Finally, the Treasury sold bonds to the Federal Reserve Bank, which issued money, and the Treasury went out and spent that money. Between 1940 and 1945, the money supply of the United States doubled as the federal government entered the marketplace, competing against private citizens for goods and services with newly printed money. And in 1946, prices were 60% higher than they'd been in 1940. Now, clearly, these inflations that I've outlined have some things in common. One, they all occurred during wartime. It is, I think, a great testament to the political and economic stability of the United States that we have never had an inflation of any real significance in the whole history of the United States which did not start during a war. Our inflation today distinguishes itself in two ways. One, it's lasted 11 years, and two, it's carried over into peacetime and is therefore the first peacetime inflation of any real significance in the whole history of the country. Secondly, each of these inflations I've outlined was caused by the federal government spending more than it taxed and printing new money to finance a portion of its deficit spending, and in the process, entering the marketplace, driving up the demand for goods and services more rapidly than industry and agriculture were able to produce those goods and services. Finally, as a testament to our forebears, when these wars were over, when our national existence was no longer in jeopardy, we took action that stopped the inflations. At the end of the Revolutionary War, we balanced the budget, we stopped printing and spending continental dollars, and when the federal government stopped competing against its citizens with newly printed money, the inflation ended. We followed exactly the same procedure at the end of the War of 1812, at the end of the Civil War, and at the end of World War I. In 1946, we had 24% inflation. Using 1945 as a base year to measure full employment during that period, relative to 1945 as full employment by current measurement techniques, we had 8.5% unemployment in 1946. And the problem was compounded by the fact that 11 million GIs were coming home to look for jobs in the private sector. The Congress passed the Employment Act of 1946, which gave President Truman broad, sweeping economic powers that no president had ever had before. There was great pressure on Harry Truman to increase government spending, to slash taxes, to stimulate the economy, to to initiate public works, lest we fall back into the Depression. Harry Truman refused to respond to these pressures and balanced the budget in the first quarter of 1947. By the end of 1947, the inflation was over. By the end of 1947, we had made the most rapid transformation from wartime production to peacetime production that any nation in history has ever achieved. And we did that not only because of the genius of the American free enterprise system, but because when the federal government balanced its budget, it freed capital for private use, which went into the private sector and built new farms, new factories, new plant and equipment, so that when the GIs came home, they found jobs in the private sector. And by the end of 1947, the unemployment problem was eliminated. From 1947 to 1945, excuse me, from 1947 to 1965, excluding 1950, when any account is taken of quality changes in consumer goods, prices were virtually stable as the federal government ran more or less balanced budget policies. In 1950, we felt the impact of the Korean conflict. We ran a large one-year deficit. We financed all of it by printing money and spending it. And we had a one-year 10% inflation. But by the end of 1951, we had a balanced budget. And by the end of 1952, the inflation was over. Now, the purpose of this little history lesson might have been to celebrate the bicentennial of the United States. But that was not the purpose. The purpose was to demonstrate that there's nothing new or novel about our current inflation problems. As Harry Truman was so fond of saying, there's nothing new in the world except the history you don't know. I think our greatest problem today is that the people who were in the last administration and the people who are about to be in the new administration, by and large, despite the fact that they're making a lot of history, don't know much. We've had a 65% increase in consumer prices in the last 10 years because in the last 10 years, the federal government's run a cumulative deficit of slightly in excess of $170 billion. It's financed over 15% of that deficit by simply printing money and spending it through the Federal Reserve Bank. And the process of entering the marketplace, competing against you and me for goods and services with newly printed money, the federal government has driven up the demand for goods and services over the last 10 years on average at a rate which has exceeded twice the rate at which industry and agriculture have been able to produce new goods and services. And as a result, for 10 years, the American worker's gone to work, earned his income, gone out to spend that income, only to find the federal government has beaten him to the marketplace, purchased some of the goods and services that he produced with newly printed money, and in competing for what's left, the American workers had to pay a higher price. Now, there are a lot of fancy names in economics and in politics for this inflation process, but there is a very simple term that I think is understood by every American school child, which describes the process perfectly, and that term is theft. And it's theft in its most destructive form because it does not fall evenly on the shoulders of all Americans. It falls disproportionately heavy on the shoulders of those who are old and retired and trying to live off fixed incomes. And it falls heavily on the shoulders of those who are trying to work, to earn, to save, to provide for their future and for the future of their children. This inflation tax not only produces inequity in the economic system, but by taxing the saver, it strikes at the very roots of economic growth and in the process generates unemployment. Despite all the talk about stopping the inflation in various ways, if one takes history as holding any lessons about the future, the only way we're ever going to stop the inflation is by balancing the budget. We don't have to cut government spending to balance the budget. For the last 18 months, federal tax collections have grown at 9.4% a year. At that rate of growth of tax collections, if we slowed down the rate of growth of overall government spending to 3% a year and held that level through the end of 1980, we'd have a balanced budget. I debated Vance Hartke in Atlanta 2 years ago, and his response to my idea about slowing down the rate of growth in government spending and imposing a 3% growth rate as a maximum was that it is impossible for the federal government to meet the needs of those who are dependent on it with a 3% growth rate a year. My response was that that may well be so, but I think it's important to note that the after-tax income of the average American family over the last 5 years has not grown at 3% a year. And it seemed to me that It was not asking too much to ask those who were riding in the wagon not to ride in any greater style and not to face any greater expansion in their budget constraint than the constraint that was faced by those people who were busy pulling that wagon. The response of the Humphrey-Hawkins bill to inflation is that inflation can be controlled by wage and price controls. And the Humphrey-Hawkins bill sets up in broad mandate form wage and price controls to be imposed at the discretion of the executive branch of government on either a mandatory or voluntary basis. Now, while we in economics know quite a bit about inflation, in terms of hard evidence, we know more about wage and price controls because records on government edicts have been kept a lot longer than records on general prices. We have clear-cut records on wage and price controls that date back to the Code of Hammurabi. We have records on wage and price controls under Pericles in ancient Athens, under Diocletian in ancient Rome, where wage, price, and interest rate controls were imposed with a death penalty, and where they created such chaos that the business sector of the Roman economy, the Roman middle class, found it to their advantage to flee across the border and live with the barbarians to carry out business rather than face wage and price controls. One of the great paradoxes of history, of course, that wage and price controls were imposed to stop the inflation, which money spent to protect Roman citizens from the barbarians was generated as part of the government deficit spending and debasement of the coinage. We have a long history of wage and price controls in the United States, and in fact, in one of our hero stories in the history of our country, wage and price controls played a prominent role. We learn in our history books, and we tell our children, that Washington's army suffered great hardship at Valley Forge because we were a poor nation and because we were unable to feed our troops and clothe them and to provide shelter for them. That's a falsehood. In order to aid the Continental Congress in 1777, Pennsylvania imposed wage and price controls, and in doing so, asked local farmers to sell to our Continental Army at about one-third the price that could be gotten by selling to the British. And so since patriotism, like George Bernard Shaw's prostitution, since patriotism is a relative thing, the supplies were sold to our enemy, and the Continental Army suffered as a result of wage and price controls. But we were governed by different men then than we are now, and they promptly repealed wage and price controls and in fact stated that it had been found from great hardship and experience that wage and price controls not only were not productive to any end, but that they were counterproductive in terms of making the very problems they sought to deal with worse. I could go into a long harangue about how there is not one single instance in recorded history that I am aware of where wage and price controls have helped any nation under any set of circumstances. If we went out and took a poll today and asked American businessmen whether they would favor wage and price controls in the event of a conventional type World War III, I assert that 90% of them would say yes. But what's the evidence on wage and price controls? There is no evidence anywhere that I have ever seen that shows that wage and price controls has ever enabled any nation in a state of siege to benefit itself. In fact, in the American experience, during World War I, we were able, with wage and price controls, if you establish a relation between growth in the money supply and growth in prices, we were able to warp that relationship and shift prices forward 1 year. But if you work the relationship out and assume constancies, the inflation overall was worse as a result of wage and price controls. The World War II experience is even clearer. With wage and price controls and mandatory rationing, we shifted inflation from 1943 and 1944 to 1945 and 1946, and in the process, we made the overall inflation suffered during the war worse. And the reason's quite simple. Wage and price controls don't change anything. They seek to freeze prices at a level where consumers plus investors plus government are willing and able to buy more than producers are able to produce. In the process, they convert rising prices into shortages. Shortages disrupt the production process, send output down, and make inflation due to government deficit spending at a given level worse than it would have been in the absence of wage and price controls. One might ask if the record is so clear-cut, and in fact, Professor Klein admitted on nationwide TV not a month ago that he knew of no single instance where wage and price controls had ever been successful in history. It is, I think, an undying characteristic of the American liberal to believe that while a program may never have worked in history, that no one in history ever believed in the program to the extent that they do, and therefore no prior occurrence is a real test of the validity of their theory. I think that the reason that we are probably going to have wage and price controls on a jawbone basis, and we could possibly have wage and price controls on a mandatory basis, is strictly political. The American people have this inbred response which calls on our elected officials to, quote, do something even if it's wrong, which, given that psychology and given the makeup of our government, produces exactly the poorest possible alternative under that cliche, and that is what they do is almost always wrong. I think it's important to note engaging the productivity of wage and price controls to look at what happens to people who impose wage and price controls. They're reelected to office. Those who administer wage and price controls become deans of business schools and go out and sell businessmen, as our famous Jackson Grayson at SMU, on conservatism as a reformed wage and price control implementer. In short, nobody loses politically by imposing wage and price controls, because the American people don't bill the culprits when the program doesn't work. If you listen to politicians, you get the idea that we've got unemployment because of inadequate spending. That if we just simply had more spending, that we'd have more jobs. The American politician has no monopoly on this approach to the problem. This summer, I was in Australia, and as part of the program I was carrying on there, I was asked to participate in a program with their ex-prime minister, Mr. Whitlam. And his basic presentation had to do with the following thing. The new liberal government, which is a socialist government, but which relative to the prior government is a conservative government, had cut his proposed budget by 17%. He had two points to make. Number one, these officials had stolen from the people of Australia 17% of government spending, which he would have given them, which they were now being deprived of. The second point is that spending was desperately needed in order to stimulate unemployment in Australia, which had tripled in the last 3 years. Well, it just so happens that I had just the day before gone over to their library at Queensland University and looked at their equivalent, the Federal Reserve Bulletin, and there aren't 3 years in the whole history of Australia where total spending grew as fast as it did over the last 3 years of the Whitlam administration. So the point that I posed to him was simply this: total spending during the last 3 years of your administration grew faster in government and in the total economy than any 3 years in the history of Australia. If more spending promotes more jobs, how come unemployment tripled? There are not a dozen years in the whole history of the United States where total spending grew by more than it did in 1974 and 1975. We have unemployment today not because of inadequate spending, but in my opinion, because of two factors. One, a very rapid growth in the population rate and the labor force participation rate. And number two, because of a disruption in the investment process. Beginning in 1972, because of the post-World War II baby boom, 4 million Americans a year started turning 21, and according to the projections that these people make, and I guess they should be sound if they can count heads and if we don't have a plague or a war, but somehow I'm always doubtful of these statistics, but in any case, this is going to peak out in 1982 at 4.2 million people. This produced a situation last year where 2 million young Americans entered the labor market for the first time looking for a job. That's the largest net new demand on the American labor market in the history of the United States. The labor force participation rate among housewives is at the highest level in American history, and the labor force participation rate among working age people is at the highest level in American history. And yet Gerald Ford stood by and swallowed while Jimmy Carter talked about the fact that not only were 7.5% of the American labor force unemployed, but there were countless millions who, out of frustration, had simply dropped out of the labor market and were not seeking jobs, but were leading lives of deprived existence in terms of economic hardship, which is unadulterated baloney in terms of hard figures. The plain truth is the president, in a very inept manner, tried to tell the American people that the total level of employment is at a record high, and that the percentage of the late working age labor force employed is near a record high. Out of the 2 million young Americans who entered the labor market last year for the first time, about one half didn't find a job. And they didn't find a job not because of inadequate spending, but because of inadequate investment. A study undertaken by Secretary Simon, that obviously President Ford did not read, showed that when you adjust the value of business inventories for inflation, when you adjust capital depreciation for its undervaluation due to inflation, that investment in American business as a percentage of national income in 1974 was at the lowest level in the recorded history of the United States. In other words, we plowed back less of what we earned as a percentage into building new plant and equipment, generating new jobs in the private sector in 1974 than we have ever done in the history of this country. And so far as I can determine, even though I'm partly making up the number, so far as I'm aware, these economic data go back to 1811. I think we can deal with the problem of lagging investment expenditures in the American economy by simply looking at an outward invisible sign of the problem. Why are mortgage rates on new homes today twice what they were in the middle 1950s? Why are AAA corporate bond rates twice what they were in the middle 1950s? Well, I think there are two reasons why these changes have occurred. Number one, in 1955, when an American earned a dollar, he could save that dollar to retire on or go into business with or send his kids to college, whatever he wanted to do with it, with some reasonable assurance that when he got ready to spend that money, that money was going to buy about what it did the day he earned it. That's not true anymore. If an American has followed the traditional channels of saving and has earned money and bought a life insurance policy with a whole life value, or has put the money into a time deposit in a commercial bank or a savings and loan association in the last 5 years, he has lost ground because the rate he has earned has been exceeded by the inflation rate. And the American people have responded to this by reducing the percentage of national income in an aggregate sense that they are saving relative to 1955. So relative to our capital needs and the size of the economy and the size of income, we are not generating as much capital as we did in 1955. Secondly, in 1955, when somebody did save a dollar, that dollar went into the private sector because the federal government was running more or less a balanced budget policy. For the last 3 years, the federal government, according to the Secretary of the Treasury, has used up about 60 cents out of every dollar raised on the American capital market, and in the process has deprived private industry and agriculture of capital that was needed to build new plant and equipment. I could go into a much more detailed discussion of the impact of government regulations, the impact of government policy on profitability outlooks, etc. But the point that I want to make is that our inadequate investment has been due to the fact that we've disrupted the American capital market. And I think a very strong case can be made that when we're running a $68 billion deficit, that when we pass so-called public employment bills to put people to work for the federal government, and we finance those programs by running deficits, and therefore either printing money, which is inflationary, or selling government bonds, which competes capital away from private industry, we are in the process probably destroying in the long run more private jobs than we are generating public jobs. The response to the Humphrey-Hawkins bill to unemployment is twofold. One is the short-term program and the other is a long-term program. The short-term program is to impose a rigid rule on the federal government, the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the Federal Reserve Bank, that any time the unemployment rate exceeds 3.5% a year, the government must expand the money supply, it must increase government spending, grant aid to the states and to the counties, and must attempt to use all monetary and fiscal devices at its disposal to stimulate the American economy. I don't need to tell you what that would have done in 1974 when we had 12.2% inflation and 7.4% unemployment. Secondly, if this does not lower the unemployment rate to 3.5%, the federal government must initiate a public employment program to absorb this excess pool of unemployment. As the bill was initially written, within 3 years after the enactment of the law, a person who was unemployed in an economy where measured unemployment exceeded 3.5% could sue the federal government, not only for the wages he was not earning, but for back wages dating from the time that 3 years after the enactment of the bill had elapsed by the time that he finally got a settlement. That facet of the bill was thrown out early. The long-run aspects of the program, in my opinion, are probably more harmful than the short-term aspects. The bill clearly asserts, in so many words, that free enterprise has failed in America, and that without overall coordination and direction, that the American economy is fundamentally unstable and will not provide full employment for the American worker. It seeks to deal with this program by establishing the wherewithal for national economic planning by creating new facets of the bureaucracy under the Labor Department and under the Council of Economic Advisors. Forces the Council of Economic Advisors to prepare a national economic plan once a year, which would be submitted to the Congress and in a conference committee that would have select members of the Congress, representatives from the Federal Reserve Bank, from the executive branch of government, and from a panel of business and labor and consumer leaders would meet and talk about the plan and propose to the legislative branch of government a final economic plan. We are assured that the economic plan would not be binding on the private sector, but it would be binding on the overall policy of the federal government, which would mean, of course, that those parts of the private sector that are highly dependent on federal financing or federal programs would, to a fairly significant extent, even at the beginning, find themselves in a position of having overall growth dictated to them by the federal government. Obviously, in a group like this, I don't have to go in and give you any kind of listing of horror stories about national economic planning. The Soviet Union and Eastern Europe have had continual problems in trying to formulate economic plans in terms of trying to carry them out and in terms of operating an efficient capital market and developing their own technology. They've been bailed out in these problems because we've given them our technology. But I don't think that we have to go very far to find any kind of comparisons between government efficiency at doing anything and private efficiency. As I used to be fond of saying back during the energy crisis, it's instructive to remember that no matter what we think of Exxon Oil Company, that they ship a gallon of gasoline from New Orleans to New York cheaper than the United States Post Office can send a first-class letter from Dallas to Fort Worth. And that was when the postal rates were 10 cents, not 13 cents. Let me conclude by simply noting the obvious that the Humphrey-Hawkins bill is bad news. Whether the Humphrey-Hawkins bill is going to be enacted or not is a political question, not an economic question. I don't claim to know the answer to that. But I think it shows a clear drift of events. I think it shows a clear drift, despite all the supposed unhappiness of the American people, in terms of the fact that obviously, if one listens to what they say, they are not happy with what our government has done. On the other hand, if one looks at what they did re-electing the same old Congress, at least in terms of the things that really count, they said, yes, you're doing a good job, keep at it. When these polls supposedly show conservative majorities, I think it's important to note that the platform of the majority party contained a proposal, the Humphrey-Hawkins bill, which is at least being considered seriously in the Congress, which would not only impose wage and price controls and make government the employer of last resort, but it would also institute national economic planning. So that while there are certainly rays of hope and I rejoice in them, I think this is a very bad sign indeed. I think that we can see the potential problems with wage and price controls by simply looking at this business where President-elect Carter and Gerald Ford are now attacking the steel industry. Here is an industry that in the last 3 years has seen the cost of labor go up by 26%, and its price to the consumer has gone up only by 22 cents. In terms of any objective measure, from their cost conditions to effective demand conditions, in terms of the ability of the market to bear the increase, that cost increase was justified in the only sense it makes any sense, and that is that the companies are not going to apparently be forced to go back and rebate or cut prices if they raise prices by that much. It's very interesting that both Ford and Carter have made public projections of the inflation rate next year to be about 6%, and yet the steel industry asked for only a selective increase in its prices of about 6%. The real problem here is, of course, that by using the steel industry as a whipping boy, the administration, both Ford and Carter, creates the impression in the public mind that American business is really causing inflation and that they're being ripped off. I think it's interesting to speculate on the motive of these two people. President-elect Carter, I think, has obviously done this for political reasons. But I think Gerald Ford has done it because I think this shows above all else that he doesn't have the foggiest idea in this world what causes prices to be what they are, how prices are set, or what causes inflation. Yeah. 2 months ago, he wouldn't have done it, because he was hoping to get the support of people in the steel industry. But he did it because he no longer needs that support, and I think it shows that he never deserved the support in the first place. Since we've talked about bureaucracy, I want to say at least one thing about bureaucracy before stopping and trying to answer a few questions. I don't believe that reform of the bureaucracy in terms of any so-called reform in terms of having a continual renewal of programs, which, as Professor Tulloch pointed out today, we already have, or setting up a new superstructure of advisory boards or individuals in control is going to have any real impact. The bureaucracy, in my opinion, is the outgrowth of two things. One, laws which give the government discretionary power that the Congress cannot carry out, and therefore a bureaucracy must be set up to carry it out. And number two, the carrying out of policy on a federal level, whereby bureaucracy is established and where the program is so distant from the people that a bureaucracy at various levels, federal, state, and local, must be established in order to administer the program. Until those basic things are changed, until we reduce the degree to which laws are passed and laws maintain their force that have discretionary power, and until we pass the conduct of things that government under some set of objective functions should be doing back to county and city and state governments, I think we're going to continue to be plagued by bureaucracy. With that, let me stop, and I'd be very glad to answer questions.
Thank you very much, Phil. Sure appreciate that. Just one word of advice. I've heard Phil's remarks so many times, I just want to give a word of advice to stop hedging your arguments. Come out a little bit more forceful, you know? Just stop pulling your punches, Phil. You're entirely too soft on inflation. With that, let's get into some of the questions and remarks we might have. Dr. Kurzgesagt.
I'd like to ask Dr. Ramgram the relationship between illegal aliens in our country and unemployment. I'm told there are some 3 or 4 million illegal aliens.
I've done no research in this area, but my wife, who's a labor economist, has, and I'm fairly familiar with it. Basically, what her findings are run as follows. Illegal aliens who are coming into the United States in a certain, along certain margins, have competed effectively for jobs. And one could possibly argue that some fraction of the amount of jobs that currently are being absorbed by these people would, under a certain set of circumstances, have gone to domestic citizens. But her conclusions in looking at the problem, especially in Texas, was that by and large, illegal aliens are performing jobs that under minimum wage laws and under the current welfare system would not be performed had they not entered the United States. And her basic conclusion is that by and large, they are more of a political whipping boy of the labor unions than they are a real cause of unemployment in the United States. That is not to argue, in my mind, against enforcing the law. It is, however, an argument that, at least in terms of the evidence that she analyzed, that there's no clear-cut case to be made that there's anything like a one-for-one displacement. In fact, her guesses, more than estimates, range that probably the displacement was in the range of 10%.
Ed Fulner?
Bill, Irving Kristol has made the argument that part of the problem in our political sector is that the Democrats always come along, spend a lot, and then it's the Republicans who come along with their responsibility and call for balanced budgets, pay for all the excesses of the Democrats. We get all the blame, they get all the credit. Here, you could insert conservative and liberal in the appropriate spot. Within the last several years, an economist of some note from the University of Chicago, following up on that, has said conservatives should really take a new tack and always be in favor of a tax cut. Forget things like balanced budgets. Just always be in favor of cutting taxes, because there's always going to be a deficit of X percent, whatever it happens to be. And that's really the position we should be taking. Now, you're both a professional economist, and you've been through the political fire. If you were in the Senate right now, you had to make a vote on something like that, a substantial tax cut, say $10, $15 billion, and without, as opposed to, for example, trying to balance the budget. Which way would you go and why?
Well, if I could, Ed, I'd rather be president than be in the Senate. So let me talk in terms of historical context. I think the biggest problem we've had is that the general public has thought that we had conservatives when indeed we didn't. It was Richard Nixon that imposed wage and price controls. It was Richard Nixon that reinflated the economy in 1969. One of the greatest problems with Gerald Ford is that in the debate, he ended up basically defending an inflation and a policy that had been caused by the Democratic Congress. I think where the real thrust was lost and where the real opportunity for Gerald Ford existed was when he first took office and he was going to give his inflation message. I don't know if you remember. And he shows up with his win button on. And he talks about how that we've all got to, you know, the consumer's got to spend less, the business got to spend less, the government's got to spend less, and talks about planting your inflation garden, and then his butts quickly point out it's the wrong time of the year to be planting a garden. But I think that the problem here was that he didn't tell the American people what the problem was and what it caused it. I think if he had walked in and said, gentlemen, I'm glad the TV's here, but I didn't need the TV here to talk to the people who've caused the inflation, and to talk to the people who can cure it. We have caused the inflation with government deficit spending for the following reasons. Now, here's what I'm going to do. In order to stop this inflation by the end of this decade, we're going to have to slow down the rate of growth in government spending to this percentage this year, lower percentage next, in a stair-step basis. Here are my proposals. I'm willing to meet you halfway. I'm willing to work with you. But I'm going to take my case to the American people. We're going to stop the spending. If you spend money to benefit special interests, you're going to have to answer to the American people, and I'm going to be there to be sure that they know what's going on. If he had done that, he would have been reelected. He would have broken their back, and Republicans would have made real gains in the Congress, in my opinion. But he pussyfooted around with the wind thing. He then panicked about the rise in the unemployment rate. He stopped listening to Simon and started listening to Laird and these other guys, apparently, and then he rushes off, and one week he's against inflation, next week to hell with inflation, it's unemployment, and the American people kind of get the idea that maybe he's not too stable. So that I don't think that conservatives ought to follow a policy of just cutting taxes. I think cutting taxes is a desirable goal, but you got to do other things to make that economically feasible. But I think the best thing that we could do is to try to explain the problem to the American people, and I think one thing that I have found is that the average guy in the street is pretty smart about economics, on everything except about governmental economics. He knows in his household that there ain't no free lunch. He knows in his business that you can't get something for nothing. But he's been convinced by Republicans and Democrats for 30 years that the simple basic laws of economics that apply in his household and his business don't apply to the federal government. He thinks that's phony and fishy, but he's not quite sure. And I think that's what we've got to tell him. I think that ultimately our
possibility of success depends on convincing the guy in the street that we know what we're talking about. He does not have to understand. It's not necessary that he understand. It's only necessary that he believes that we know what the hell we're talking about. And I think that that was one thing that Ford could never convince them, basically because that was not true. Yes, sir. Well, of course, I can't speak for anything like the rank and file Democrat. I think, have some sense of what the Texas voter wants, and he's overwhelmingly Democratic. I think the Texas voter is basically conservative. I think that the Democrats are going to do whatever they have to do in order to get reelected. And that if we want them to be conservative, then we've got to convince the voter to demand it. And if they do that, we're going to have people like Walter Mondale talking as conservative as Barry Goldwater, as indeed he did in certain parts of the campaign. So one of the advantages that most elected officials have, Democrat and Republican, Republicans probably less so, but still, I think if one looks at the overall voting records of numerous Republicans, including the vice presidential candidate, you find there is a great deal of flexibility and pragmatism. And so I think in terms of trying to promote the programs we want, that obviously in the long run we want to elect people. But even in the short run, I think we can get desirable results if we could somehow communicate with the guy in the street. How to do that, I don't have the foggiest idea.
Paul Belknap. Maybe she can speak next year. Want to remark to that, Phil?
By looking at her, I didn't guess, but God bless her.
Great, wonderful. Just make a comment, if the noise gets any loud over there, I suggest we adjourn and join them. It sounds like they're having a good time over in the next room. Adson Perry.
I object to it simply because the tap of the magic wand diverts attention away from the problem, and exactly because it has the cosmetic effects that you claim it does. And I'll give you an example. Under President Nixon's phase 2 and 3 price controls, the cosmetics were applied, diverted the attention of the public, created in the public mind that there was a possibility of relief, did possibly to some extent moderate increases, took pressure off the budgetary process, And Richard Nixon's administration ran a $23 billion deficit that year as a result, in part, of the fact of having diverted the public's attention away to the cause of the problem. So I think the cosmetic would be effective if medicine were simultaneously being applied. But I think the use of the cosmetic lessens the pressure to use the medicine. And I think that's a real problem. The claim of the sophisticated wage and price controller is exactly the claim you made. Take, for example, when Nixon tried to stop the inflation in the first half of 1969. Union contracts in the fall of 68 had been made basically on the assumption of a 5% inflation, 2% productivity growth, roughly a 7% negotiation. Had Nixon continued Johnson's policy, nothing would have happened except 5% inflation. Nixon threw on the brakes very rapidly, zero growth in the money supply January to June. In June, the consumer price index was down to 2.7%. So these guys who negotiated the 7% wage increase said, hey, we can't pay these wages with 2.7% increase in price. They laid off people, unemployment rate went up, Nixon panic reinflated. So the argument is that this enables you to control expectations. And to some extent, that has, in my opinion, validity. But it also has a big advantage in that it takes pressure off the government in the areas where medicine is applied. And a government which will have inflated in the first place, and a government that's likely to be trying to use cosmetic wands, is a government that is not going to take the penicillin shot unless we're there continually overlooking the process. So that's the only, the best response that I can give to that.
Further questions? George Shibley.
The point you made earlier, which I think is an excellent question, that is why our administrations, and also relates to the point you just made, why our administrations always returning to this cosmetic idea of wage price controls when the evidence is so clear. In light of the topic of this conference, that is a bureaucracy, I think it's clear, in light of what Professor Tulloch has told us, in terms of the benefits that accrue to the bureaucracy, it's very clear why they always support it. Because obviously, inflation, wage price controls are always going to lead to bigger and bigger government, more and more government control, and larger and larger bureaucracy.
I agree with you.
Any further questions? Well, thank you very much, Phil.